I'm happy to be here again. I give a talk on some undefined subject. So I didn't provide an abstract or title. And the main reason, well, sometimes I just forget in many cases. But in this particular case, I just wasn't sure what the title should be and also what the abstract should be. And I was trying to figure out over the last few days what it should be. I didn't completely figure it out. So the talk is going to be, there's going to be no punchline. So I'm just going to share some thoughts I have about some work we did with Nikita Sapenko, my former graduate student, who is now postdoc at IAS, and some, it also was influenced by some conversation with Owen Gwilliam and Bas Janssens. So here's my motivation. A long-standing problem or issue is that there's no satisfactory mathematical formulation of quantum field theory. A very nagging problem. It's been like this for like 70 years, I think. So since, well, maybe more, depends when you think QFT started the physics subject. So it's really annoying. I mean, I actually made a list of other theories that have been and time it took to formulate them precisely. And the worst until QFT was quantum statistical mechanics. It took about 50 years from the work of Gibbs to satisfactory formulation using measure theory or C-star algebra, depending on quantum and classical. So that's been only 50 years. QFT has been over 70 years and still nowhere close to formulating precisely. Now, there is, as I mentioned, satisfactory or fairly satisfactory theory of quantum statistical mechanics, especially for lattice systems. Even for continuum systems, there's still issues, but for lattice systems, it's fairly complete in the sense that there's a setup, and then you can, lots of problems you can address within that setup. Now, the two subjects are very much related, and I'd like maybe to try to make progress in understanding QFT using something we learn about lattice systems. So let me explain what I mean by this, because there are many relations, very different relations between StatMac and QFT. Well, first of all, it's a fact that gapless degrees of freedom of lattice systems, by lattice system and quantum lattice systems only. So classical lattice systems, they're really a subject in probability theory. They don't have dynamics typically. So I'm talking about quantum lattice systems, so there is some dynamics. First of all, gapless degrees of freedom are described by QFT in many cases. Also, when there are no gapless degrees of freedom, then dealing with a gapped lattice system, then we can often describe Lorentz physics using topological quantum field theory. Again, not in all cases. We now have examples of fractons, which cannot be so described. Even if you have a gapped lattice system, you can have robust gapless edge modes, like in the case, say, of systems in two dimensions with quantum Hall effect. And those are described by quantum field theory. Not always. We're not sure why it should be described by quantum field theory, but that's the most natural description. And this is actually the last, it's the last item which I would like to understand better, because I think it provides the best chance to relate the two subjects in a precise way. So what's the relation? We have a QFT quantum field theory on the edge and a lattice, gap lattice system in the bulk. And you have a symmetry, continuous symmetry, for example, for simplicity, of the bulk system. They often act anomalously on the edge, quantum field theory. So that is it, anomalously meaning that the action has a Tuft anomaly. And a Tuft anomaly, I'll explain the next slide, remind you what this is, but it's actually believed that all the Tuft anomalies of the edge quantum field theory can be determined simply from the bulk wave function. And I submit that even though people think we do understand Tuft anomalies, I don't think we actually do completely understand them. For example, why they're so robust. And so that's a good chance to understand in what context you can even define a Tuft anomaly. That maybe shed some light on quantum field theory. Now, even though there is general belief that Tuft anomalies of the QFT quantum field theory on the edge are related to something in the bulk, some property of the bulk wave function, that's far from obvious. And I submit that actually for gravitational anomalies, there's no good argument at all. So it might even be wrong as far as I'm concerned. So I'm not going to touch on gravitational. Well, gravitational anomalies have to do with anomalies in diffeomorphism symmetry. Lattice systems don't have diffeomorphism symmetries. It would be really actually quite amazing if you could show that this information is also encoded somehow in the bulk wave function. Okay, so in this talk, I will talk about the situations when you have an internal symmetry that is not acting on space-time, and I'll assume there's some maybe compact Lie group G, and I actually will mostly talk about the case of U1, because it contains already all the important things. Let me remind you how more precisely this Atwood anomaly matching works in, well, matching the bulk and boundary works in this case. Well, in this case, if you look at the first non-trivial case where something like this happens is in two dimensions, two spatial dimensions in the bulk. So the edge is one-dimensional. First of all, the bulk system has a homotopy invariant. In the sense, the ground state has a homotopy invariant, something which doesn't change under deformation of the bulk wave function, which doesn't close the gap. It's called the Hall conductance, or zero temperature Hall conductance, more precisely. I'll explain later how to figure it, read it off the bulk wave function. Now, if you consider the system on a half plane, well, what has been considered the same system on a half plane? It's actually not even clear, but roughly speaking, choose some boundary condition. Then you have a robust gapless edge modes described by U1 invariant quantum field theory. Well, this part is actually not understood, not even clear what it means to have an edge, strictly speaking, for the same, how to relate, what it means to have a bulk system, which is defined on infinite space, and the system with an edge. Because, you know, strictly speaking, this invariant sigma is defined only for infinite volume system. So you have to work on the whole, the system has to be infinite, defined everywhere on the plane. That's the only chance for it to have to be non-zero, right? So it's invariant, you have a gap system. The action of this U1 has a Tufte anomaly, and what it means, it cannot be gauged, cannot be promoted to an action of a group of smooth maps from the real line or space to U1. So that's what you call a Tufte anomaly. And the abstraction to gauging is again a single real number, and it's believed that it's always equal to sigma to this Hall conductance of the bulk system. So there's no proof because, we only know how to define sigma precisely, and we don't know how to define edge quantum field theory precisely. It would be nice to have, well, my motivation, again, more concretely in this talk, is to just try to make this correspondence between anomalies, these abstractions to gauging in the edge and this Hall conductance in the bulk more obvious, like more natural. Because the way, you know, Hall conductance, what does Hall conductance have to do with any abstraction to gauging? Not clear. So I'd like to, you know, maybe, I will not touch the edge QFT, I'll just try to recast a definition of a Hall conductance in a way which makes clear that it's anomaly, it's also anomaly in the same sense, some sense. Okay. So first of all, let me remind you what the lattice, how to talk about, think about lattice systems within quantum statistical mechanics. Lattice is typically just a hypercubic lattice in Euclidean space. It doesn't have to be, that's not terribly important. You may consider some Delaunay subset, which means some subset of points with the following properties. Any two points are separated, or the subset lambda are separated by some fixed distance. In particular, we don't have any accumulation points, but it's actually stronger than that, right? You really have universal lower bound for distance between all point, any points. And second, your subset fills the whole Euclidean space kind of uniformly. So there's some, pick any point of Euclidean space, it is within some fixed distance of the subset lambda. So that's good enough. You don't have to be like a regular lattice or anything. I'm not going to use translational symmetry. And on each side, we have a finite dimensional Hilbert space. And we place a finite corresponding matrix algebra, which I call AJ, on this site. And then we take a product over all sites of these matrix algebras. That's a star algebra, and we complete it using the norm and get a C-star algebra. And it's elements of this algebra called quasi-local observables. Well, it's actually a very good name because quasi-local observable, well, it's localized, but we don't know where, somewhere. And there's no precise like way to say how well it's localized. This information is not even inside this, it's not in this algebra. Actually, if you ask what does this algebra depend on, it doesn't depend on anything except the list of dimensions of these vector spaces. So for example, if every vector space here is a qubit, so it's two-dimensional, you get the same algebra regardless of the dimension of D of space. So if you want to get something in the end, something which depends on dimension, you have to put some extra information somewhere. So this object, this A, is too rough an object, doesn't have much information. Now, key observation which made quantum statistical mechanics possible is that this is the preferred formulation. There's no Hilbert space anywhere here. And the Hilbert space only appears via the Gelfand-Naimark-Sigal construction. So that is, you need to specify a state, which physically usually means a ground state, but here just a state. And state just means a positive linear function on this algebra, meaning that its values on elements of this form are non-negative. So given that state, you can turn the crank and you get this Hilbert space. And moreover, you have a representation of this algebra by bounded operators on this Hilbert space. So B of H is the algebra of bounded operators. So you get the homomorphism from, once you have this state, you can construct the Hilbert space and homomorphism from A to the bounded operators in the Hilbert space. And then you need to specify dynamics also, which I haven't done yet, but maybe I'll mention later how it's defined. Now, if you compare, well, let's compare with the quantum statistical, with quantum field theory. Well, there are many different formulations of attempts at formulating quantum field theory. The attempt which I like the best and which is closest to this quantum statistical mechanics is Haag-Kassler approach. And there, there's no complete version of that, by the way. So it's just a proposal, fairly vague proposal. But you can check, read about more about it in Haag's book, Local Quantum Physics. And it's kind of interesting reading because it summarizes, this line of thought and, for over many decades, and it's still clear that it's very far from complete picture. And part of the reason, I think, is because Haag lacks some mathematical language to express what he wants to say. What happens there, they attached something, namely C-star algebra, to every region of open regions of space-time. If this is an inclusion of one region to another, you get, this corresponding algebra just included subalgebra of the algebra in the bigger region. So mathematically, this algebras, the sister algebras organize themselves into a pre-Kashif of algebras on space-time. What does it mean? Well, in general, if you have some category in topological space, you can define what I mean by a pre-Kashif on X. And the space X with the values in this category. It's simply an assignment of some object of this category to every open subset, and a morphism in the same direction as an inclusion works. So if you have like U included in V, you have a morphism from one object to another. And compatibility with like composition of inclusions maps to composition of morphisms. We can also say it's quicker by saying it's just a functor from the category of opens in X to C, and it's category whose objects are open subsets of X and morphisms and inclusions of open subsets. So that's what the starting point of Haag-Kassler, and then they impose all kinds of other requirements on this. But let's just look at it looks pretty similar to what we have in QFT. Well, before I proceed, let me just say that. The meaning of this. So this, you can think of this morphisms from this object to object that's a bigger subset, a sort of extension. In the case of observables, you just start with observables in a small subset and just extend it by identity elsewhere. It's extension by one. Now, another example of pre-Kashif, for example, if you look at in the classical, you know, without any physics, just say, well, you can attach, look at some space and can consider, say, attaching to every subset U compactly supported smooth functions on U. So in that case, it's also therefore also organizing the absence into pre-Kashif. In that case, you extend by zero. So if you have a bigger subset, well, just extend your function by zero and get another function. And that actually can be used to, this sort of thing can be used to model gauge transformations. Because a gauge transformation is localized in some subset and just zero outside. That would be like a natural thing. And you can think about the pre-Kashif of gauge transformations. Now, pre-sheaves are more familiar than pre-Kashifs. Let me remind you how that works. Well, that's just a functor, basically from the opposite category to C. So in that case, the dimorphisms go in the opposite way. So you have some object of C for every open, but then when you have an inclusion of U into V, you have the morphisms from the bigger subset to the smaller subset. So you restrict things rather than extend them. And then you probably heard that there are some also, also sheaves, and they're just special examples of pre-sheaves, which have additional compatibility with locality, which kind of is going to be important because locality is important in quantum field or QFT as well. So we expect actually maybe co-sheaves are important, not just pre-co-sheaves, but more on this later. Yes?
Can you say again the distinction between what you're calling extension by one and extension by zero?
No, I'm just saying that they're different. You know, it's very abstract formalism. So just in practice, you have something defined with set, and if you have some canonical way to extend on a bigger set, then it's going to be probably a pre-Kashif, okay? So it just, depending on the context, could be extending by whatever, by some 0, 1. In quantum, is there some similar story in quantum statistical mechanics? Well, maybe we should say, well, not just attach, consider this one big algebra, A, of course, the local observables, but maybe attach, consider like some root or some subset of Euclidean space, and in this case, just space, you know, time is different. So we just consider some subset of our space and consider just taking this algebra of local observables inside this U. By just taking tensor product of all these AJs and then complete it. And then you're going to get maybe something you could call observables localized on U. Okay. So that looks similar to Haag-Kastler, but not particularly natural. So what's the problem? Well, first of all, localization is never, it's not very useful to consider exact localization in quantum statistical mechanics because evolution actually doesn't preserve this. Like if you take something localized in some region and then evolve it, it's not going to be localized in any region, it's going to be everywhere. So now there is something nice about evolution, if you have a nice Hamiltonian. There's something called Lib-Robinson bound, which says that if you have an action of the, if you evolve your observables by time evolution using a nice Hamiltonian, all what nice means depends on the context, then your evolved observable is approximately localized still on this same region for all times. So for example, if the interactions between any two points decay faster than any power of the distance, then the tails of these evolved observables, there is something, the failure to be localized on the same U, they actually also decay faster than any power of distance. But that's not, that suggests you need to do something different here in the quantum statistical mechanics case. You cannot literally work with co-sheaves or something like that. Now, what I mean by dynamics? Dynamics, when to specify it, you need to, infinitesimally, you just want to define Hamiltonian, and Hamiltonian is a derivative, acts by commutators. Put it on the algebra observables, which mathematically means by derivations. So you need to specify some derivation of the algebra observables, which typically looks like this. So it's a sum, infinite sum of commutators. So each of them individually, just a commutator with another element, but the sum doesn't converge. No, the sum of this HJ doesn't converge. So the sum of the commutators, though, does converge for every fixed, for every sufficiently nice A. Now, sufficiently nice means actually it doesn't actually converge for arbitrary observable, but converges on some dense subset of this, which is called D, of this A. Now, so you have such a nice derivation, you can hope, you can exponentiate it, to an actual automorphism of the algebra observables, and that automorphism actually is defined for all elements of A, not just on the dense domain. And it's actually a consequence of Lib-Robinson bounds, and for nice Hamiltonians like the one I mentioned on the previous slide, you can actually do it. For applications, we like to define of this technology. We like to consider not just any ground states, consider something called gapped ground states. In that case, we can hope to get this connection between some homotopy invariance of a bulk wave function to the edge QFT. And the gap, this is the definition of gap ground state. It's a state with the following property. There is some, it's a state for the algebra, such, and there's some delta such that the following property holds for arbitrary observable. So it looks pretty weird, but if you translate it into the language of GNS representation, just means that the spectrum of some of the derivation corresponding, well, of the Hamiltonian corresponding to this evolution, Hamiltonian in the sense of operators in the Hilbert space. So that spectrum only has a single zero energy state, and the rest of the energy spectrum lies here. So that's exactly what I mean by unique gap ground state. So just easy to write this down because it doesn't use the GNS representation, just an equation for the state. And more generally, you can consider symmetries, continuous symmetries, and if you have some Lie group symmetry, well, roughly it's just a homomorphism from your group G to the automorphism of this algebra of causal local observables. But that's not enough. Typically, we consider symmetries which act locally or approximately local. That's one thing. And second, well, strictly speaking, you need to also say that, we have a Lie group. Lie group is a group and also a manifold. So you want probably demand this homomorphism to be smooth as well. It's not just algebraic homomorphism, but you know, it should be a map from this manifold to that manifold. But that, why is this a manifold? We need to define what I mean by maybe restrict somehow your notion of automorphism so that actually space for such automorphisms are a manifold in some sense. Okay, and that can all be done as follows. First of all, proceeding with this rough definition, we'll say, how do you define locality? In what sense symmetry acts locally or approximately local? Well, the same way is for Hamiltonians. You can just say, symmetry is can be obtained by exponentiating a derivation. It's defined only in some dense domain called duration F. And when I say it's local, it means this looks like this again. So there's some, it's an infinite sum over all sides of the lattice. And on each side, there is some observable, which we call charge sitting on that side. And in some sense, this charge is localized near J. In most cases, it actually literally sits on J, on the side J. But more generally, you can consider something localized near that site. Now, so this is very rough. So technically, you need to define what it means to be localized near J, because as I said, because local observables, for example, they don't even have any notion of localization near any particular site. You really would like two symmetries to form a Lie algebra. Otherwise, you know, that would be, you would never get this to be a map of Lie groups in any sense. And that's a bit of a problem because a different derivation might have different domain. So if you try to commute them, you won't be able to do that because commutator is not even defined on a, the two domains might have zero overlap. So, and also another issue is that, when you write expressions like this, it's clear that this Fj is not going to be uniquely defined. So that's a further important issue.
Is Fj an Aj, or is it?
Well, for now, we're not, it is, but it's more than, it's a bit more specific than that. So we need to, Aj, elemental causal local observables just live anywhere. They're very, not much information saying that something is an A. You need something more specific than that. So all these technical issues can be solved by using the same kind of, same approach as what's done in quantum mechanics. For example, in quantum mechanics, we consider, Hilbert space. All Hilbert spaces of infinite dimension are the same. You send the one, you send them all. But in reality, we never work with, when you say Hilbert space of particle is L2 functions on whatever, some space, you really mean that you also think about smooth function of the space, or there's some dense subspace in that Hilbert space. Similarly here, that carries more information, it carries physical information. And here, you also want to define some subalgebra of almost local observables. for which actually have a notion of localization. And it's convenient to take the one where observable sits in the subalgebra, if it can be approximated by a local observable, that is some finite product of these matrices, on a ball of radius R with very good accuracy, with accuracy which is better than, well, it gets better and better, faster than a polynomial. Okay. So this algebra is actually very nice because it's a topological algebra. It's not a C star algebra, but it's a Fréchet star algebra. It has some topological, natural topology, and it's dense here. And you can just, for most purposes, you can just work with derivation, which all leave on this, which define on this subalgebra, and moreover preserve it. So in that case, that you get this. That's how they look. You know, each of these HJs is now leaves in this subalgebra, and it's well localized near this J in that sense. It's a perfectly well defined Lie algebra. So it's actually Fréchet Lie algebra of nice derivations. It's made of elements like that. The derivations like that. And well, so I'll denote this algebra with this curly D. AL means almost local. And that solves most of technical issues. You can actually, I'll just skip the slide, so you can just say exponentiate these guys using Lieb-Robinson bounds. You can show that any such derivation can be exponentiated. In fact, any time-dependent derivation of this form can be exponentiated to an automorphism. And this allows you to define a notion of a distinguished automorphism of this, namely the one which has this form exponential with such a time-dependent derivation, and in some sense such special automorphisms, which are called LGAs, they do form an infinite-dimensional Lie group. So with that definition, you can now make sense of the statement that a symmetry is a homomorphism from a Lie group, finite-dimensional one, to this one, to the group of these LGAs. So, okay, so this, I repeat here. So a symmetry then homomorphism from an abstract group G to the group of these special automorphisms. And if it's a Lie group, then it's smooth homomorphism. I'm not going to say exactly what it is, but it can be done. Now, for example, for U1, all that you need to do is to specify this such homomorphism just given by a charge, namely some derivation, and with the condition that it's, you know, exponentiate. Get identity. In this case, well, I could absorb square root of minus 1 into Q, so my Q is anti-self-adjoint. It's convenient to do that. And now we can also do the following thing. So it's clear how to define a gene-variant Hamiltonian and how to define gene-variant state. A gene-variant state is simply the one which is unchanged if you compose it with the automorphism of the algebra. This condition is equivalent to the following condition using just the generator of that symmetry. It just means that if you the average of the action of this derivation on any observable is zero. That's what it means for that. It's actually the same as state being invariant. In the usual approach, you know, people would write this as an average of the commutator of Q and A is zero for any A. I'll call such derivations of, in general, derivations which don't excite the state. So state being invariant means the corresponding charge does not excite it. Okay. And these derivations form a Lie subalgebra of this algebra. And of course, they can be exponentiated. So you can ask, okay, what? So this is a good definition of this symmetry Lie algebra of this of a state. It makes sense to ask, okay, given that symmetry Lie algebra, can I localize it? In a sense, can I gauge it? Can I promote it to something which is, you know, here the parameters are simply elements of the group, Lie group. Can I gauge it in the sense that I can define what I mean by symmetry transformation of a state which is just lives in some particular subset of the lattice? What does it mean? Well, here comes another this issue I already mentioned, that there are ambiguities in these charge densities, both in field theory and quantum physical mechanics. In field theory, well, you have the charges given by the integral of a charge density of your space, and the ambiguity is simply shifting your charge density by something exact. In statistical mechanics, your charge is given by this, well, it's element, well, I write, it's given by commutator, so I write it this way. So if I strip off the little a, I said the charge is given by sum of commutators with q, little qj's. And each qj is some observable or well-localized near j. And ambiguity is present here as well in the following form. If you replaced q tilde j, qj with q tilde j, which is the old charge on its side j plus some sum like this, where these p's, they are skew-symmetric, well-localized near both k and j, and decay rapidly, then it's easy to see that that doesn't actually change the sum. Like if you sum over both, say, these expressions here over j, and then the sum of the extra term will just vanish because of the skew symmetry. Okay. Sum over both j and k, they drop out. The sum is convergent because, well, it's well-defined. Anyway. By the way, the third condition actually follows from the first two. So you don't need to impose it separately. Okay, so there are some ambiguities. And you can see that on the lattice, summation over psi is kind of the analog of Durham differential. I can make it precise, but I won't do it here. You look it up in the paper with Nikita. Now suppose we have this generator of U1 symmetry. So it's a symmetry of a state in the following sense. It lives in this subalgebra, so it doesn't excite the state. And exponential is to 1. So can promote it to a local symmetry of the state. Now that seems a bit crazy because we don't have any gauge fields. Why? How do you gauge? Why should we be able to gauge anything without having a gauge field? Nevertheless, actually, it's almost possible to do so because there is the following result. So if you have a gapped state, then one can always choose these ambiguities so that the new charge does not excite omega for every site-wise. It's kind of surprising. So you have a total charge, which is of course a symmetry of a state, and then it turns out you'd like to have local charges, which also are symmetries of the state, infinitely many. You would think that's not going to happen, but actually it always happens for a gapped ground state. You can always choose this q tilde j to be symmetries of the state, and moreover, you can choose them to be U1 invariant. So does it mean that you can always gauge U1 symmetry by having conserved sort of symmetries of state on each side? Well, no, because what about these commutators? If they were really U1, yes?
Sorry, how much does this depend on omega? Like, is everything in DAL in some DAL omega?
Yeah. So it only depends on the fact that the state is gapped. So Kitaev proved it.
If I just pick some random, almost local symmetry, without fixing the state, can I?
Sorry, without what?
If I have a symmetry that doesn't preserve the state, can I find some state that's gapped or anything? Is there anything I can?
If I have a symmetry which does not preserve the state, then.
Then you just don't call it a symmetry.
It's okay, there. It's not a symmetry. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. The surprising thing can actually. So the context which result first appeared in Kitaev's work was a case of Hamiltonian. So Hamiltonian, of course, preserves its own ground state. Because I can like write it in a way which is each term, each density, energy at each side also is a symmetry. It turns out, yes, you can. Nevertheless, these energies don't commute, so they're not commuting Hamiltonians. And in general, when you have like this charge, these don't commute. So it won't be U1 symmetry, in other words, in general. Now, of course, there's a lot of freedom on how you choose this p, so maybe you can choose this q tilde so they do commute. And if you can, then then you can gauge the symmetry. Okay, let's see. And now that there is a easy way, well, there's an obstruction which you can determine. Well, how do you know? Well, there is one anomaly indicator which tells you that you can never do what I just said. You know, if it's non-vanishing, then you cannot never find this q tilde so they all commute. And preserve the state and don't excite the state. So, and that for two-dimensional states. Now, one can generalize this to arbitrary even-dimensional states. In odd dimensions, I'm not aware of any obstructions. Doesn't mean that there are none, but these are just obstructions we can construct. So, in two dimensions, it looks as follows. You divide your, this is the way described in our paper with Nikita, we divide our plane into three sectors. They don't have to be like so symmetric, just three cones with a common origin. Now you pick some charges of the sort I described, namely the ones which are symmetries of the state, and you form this Q tildes for each sector like this. You just sum of this little Q tildes over with J's which lie in this sector. Now that your total charge is just sum of these three charges. This Q tildes are approximately localized in their respective sector because little Q tildes are, again, they have tails. So that's one reason one needs to work with tails, because to prove this theorem, you need to allow tails. If you don't allow tails, the theorem is not correct. So these Q tildes, they have only approximately localized in these three sectors. Now, next, consider the commutator of, say, Q tilde 1 and Q tilde 2. Well, first we can subtract total Q. That doesn't change the commutator. But then, that's the same as Q tilde minus Q tilde 1 minus Q tilde 3. And so the Q tilde 1 commutator is 0, so you're just left with that. So, and now we think about this. Well, this commutator, whatever it is, it's some derivation which is almost approximately localized on the boundary of 1 and 2. And on the other hand, this one is localized on the boundary of 1 and 3. So it must be, therefore, that since they're equal, the result must be actually a derivation which is approximately localized near the origin. And all such derivations are, you can show, are commutators with the local observables, approximately local observables. So this commutator is actually a commutator with some local observable little a. It's anti-self-adjoint, and you can take its average. Now, of course, in defining this number, we made a whole bunch of choices. We made choice of this little q tildes, made choice of three regions. But turns out this number is independent of any choices made. So the argument is a bit not very aesthetic, but I'm not going to go into that. You can look in the paper. The number is actually proportional to the zero temperature Hall conductance of the state omega. A non-zero Hall conductance then signifies that one cannot promote U1 to a gauge symmetry of the state, because if you could, this number would just vanish. Okay. So for Q tildes, the point is that this number doesn't depend on the choice of Q tildes. So if there was a choice which made them all commuting, then it would vanish. So for general Lie group, you can do a similar thing. You can define an anomaly indicator for two-dimensional state, which for two-dimensional states take values in gene-variant symmetric bilinear forms on the Lie algebra of the group. Incidentally, it's the same as whatever classifies Chern-Simons couplings, Chern-Simons actions for the group G in 2 plus 1 dimensions, which is not surprising because Hall conductance is described by, non-abelian case described by Chern-Simons action. You can do it in higher dimensions too, then you're going to get just, not bilinear, but multilinear symmetric forms. Okay, so that, in some sense, I already answered the question I posed. Very vague question, to make Hall conductance become an obstruction to some gauging, already in the bulk, without ever invoking gauge symmetry, invoking the edge. But there's some, it's not very satisfactory, it's satisfactory in some sense, but not ideal. So first of all, it's not very clear. We constructed some anomaly indicator, but maybe there's some others. Did we find them all? Physics says probably we did, but why did we use cones? What's so special about these conical regions? Maybe get some more indicators if you use some other regions. What happens if you consider a system which is gapped and leaves, say, only in half the plane, or maybe some cone? Now, physics will tell you, well, if you have a gapped system on a half space, for example, then so that means you have an edge, and on this edge, there are no gapless edge modes. So you would expect that the U1 anomaly is trivial, right? Because your edge QFT, now in this case, just has a gap, so U1 anomaly must be trivial, and therefore the whole context must be trivial. So how do we see that this invariant always vanishes if you do the same thing but on a half plane?
So if I understand correctly, you're saying, you know, in 2D you can get, say, the integer quantum Hall invariant out of this.
Well, just it's not integer; it's a number.
The Hall kind of
yeah.
But so you know, another kind of if you like similar thing is you know quantum spin Hall, right? So is that a different? That doesn't seem to turn up here, right? The Z2 invariant.
Well, yeah, that's harder. Yeah, so anything related to time reversal is harder, and only describes story for infinitesimal anomalies. So
okay.
So there is a.
So it's like it's the abstraction yeah. has something to do with this local anomaly implosion.
Yeah, I would love to know how to do it for the quantum spin Hall effect. Now you could ask, okay, can we show that say for some short range angle state, for example, this number sigma is integer? And you can do that. Yeah, that's possible to do. I'm not going to get into that, but one can do that. Yeah, but time quantum spin Hall is a very interesting question. Again, so yeah, I just said that. Okay, so we did something very special to the whole plane. What happens if you do the same thing but with some subset? Maybe have some system that lives on a part of the Euclidean plane. You would expect more for half space. You expect to get zero always. How do you see that? Also, what was so special about Euclidean space? I mean, maybe I could have taken some curved space and have some lattice there. Would I get more invariants? Would I get, what would I get? So it's not clear what's so special about Euclidean space. Physically, of course, it's special, but there's no clearly the metric information was added at some point because with decay properties depend on the metric. Presumably it should be possible to have the same, consider it's just formally, not because it's physically interesting, just a system where you have some discrete metric space. Can still define this with local observables, and if you have a nice metric space, I think in the sense that the number of points in a ball of radius r grows at most polynomially with r, then you can do the same thing as we did here, and pose the same question. So, and I can ask how many anomaly indicators are there in that case? I have no idea. So it would be nice to have some better understanding of this. No, I don't have a better understanding, but let me have some. Part of the story related to this notion of a Prekhorov on lattice, some analog of that. So, okay, so suppose, let me first remind you what a sheaf is because it's more familiar. So, suppose you have this pre-sheaf of vector spaces. So, your target category is vector spaces, so attach a vector space to each open subset of a topological space. Now, a sheaf is simply a Prekhorov so that you can relate. You have some cover of an open set by some smaller open subsets, then you can relate this vector space and these vector spaces by an exact sequence like this. So we have here product of these vector spaces, and here we have more products of the pairwise vector spaces. Now the meaning of this is the following. So this exact sequence simply says that if a section well, element of this space, which is usually called a section of a sheaf over U, is the same as a collection of sections of over elements of the cover with the condition that they agree on all pairwise intersections. So, so the fact that the image of this guy is equal to, like, the image of this F of U under this map is equal to the kernel, this one is precisely the condition that the sections must agree on double overlaps. That's what a pre-sheaf is. You can glue stuff, you can glue elements of sections from sections on subsets. Now, a kasheaf is less familiar, but it's defined essentially the same way. So you have a pre-kasheaf is a kasheaf, is if you can, for any open subset and any cover, open cover, you can relate this space to these spaces via sort of reversed exact sequence. Now you have this, everything goes in the opposite direction. Well, what does it mean though? Well, what it means is that a section of this sheaf vector space over U is the same as a collection of sections of individual elements of the cover modulo some ambiguity which comes from pairwise intersections. Okay. So in this case, you don't have a condition, you have a factor. Some ambiguity in how you present your element here as a collection of elements there. And technical issue, why do you write this sum here and product there? Well, it's only makes a difference when your cover is infinite. If your capital A is finite, it's literally the same thing, but if it's infinite, then there's a difference. So this guy is a vector space of it's a collection of elements of each of these guys, but only a finite number of them zero, is non-zero. But with product, you have no such constraints. So you can easily, it's a good exercise to realize why you actually need this thing. Anyway, so that's already sort of reminiscent of what we were doing before. So if you remember, when you constructed this anomaly indicator, we started with a charge, which is a derivation, and we decompose this derivation into a sum of derivation living on three regions. So that's the fact that the map from f of u a's to f of u is surjective. You manage to present like this, and you can ask, okay, what is the ambiguity? Like, remember I said that one can prove that the anomaly indicator doesn't depend on the choice of various choices. This decomposition is not unique, of course. You need to understand how if you choose a different decomposition, what happens? And you can show that ambiguity, say in q tilde 1, q tilde 2, q tilde 3, precisely comes from the fact you can, if something lives here on this, say, between u1 and 3, can attribute it to 1 or 3. So that's again like a Kashif property. The ambiguity comes from intersections in some sense.
This is just analogy because your intersection is still everywhere.
It's an analogy, yeah. So, okay, now, first of all, what do I mean by intersection? Well, for example, in the way I drew these regions, there was no intersection actually. They were, if the container is open, if you remove this red line, they're open, they had no intersection. Now, what could I do? Well, first of all, I didn't have to use these regions which I drew. I could have used the region with overlap, actual overlap. It wouldn't make any difference. Also, I could have, in the opposite direction, could remove things. If I look at the regions like this, it's covered in red. We don't cover the whole plane, just have three cones, some stuff is missing. Well, that actually is not going to work. There's no way to write derivation defined on the whole plane as a sum of derivations localized here, this region, it turns out. But so these regions actually don't work, these three regions. They don't form a cover in some vague sense. But these regions, even though there are gaps between them, but these gaps don't grow with distance. So since my localization is, vague, fuzzy, so then these regions, even though they don't have actually any overlap, they do work. I could have used them instead. So, So to make this analogy precise, one needs to come up with some notion of generalized union, meaning in the sense that I want to say that, define what I mean by three regions which approximately cover the whole space, so that this does work and this doesn't. And second, I want to define generalized intersections, so that these two guys even don't have actual intersection, they have sort of generalized intersection. Okay. So what I learned from Owen William is that there's actually there's a similar story in analysis, namely, there's something called, one would like to sometimes define notion of topology much more general than notion of topology, like topology in a classical sense. And that helps to deal with the functions which have some properties, like, say, growth or decay. So specifically, in analysis, one also considers functions, say, which are bounded or grow not faster than polynomials. They don't form a sheaf in normal sense, but one can nevertheless organize them into a sheaf when one uses some other notion of topology, growth-indic topology. that allows you to form, well, to work with analytic problems like an algebraic geometry would work. Dually, I don't think it appears in literature, but you have functions with decay conditions, like we have, what we have, like decaying superpolynomially. Then they organize into a co-sheaf. So again, like if you literally had compact support, you'd organize the co-sheaf in a classical sense. But when decay outside your set, then you can form a co-sheaf and maybe in the sense of the Grothendieck topology. So let now have a one page review of Grothendieck topology. So in general, it's pretty yucky definition, but luckily we won't need it, as you'll see. So in general, we just want to replace the category of opens in a subset in a set in a space X with some other category. And you want to replace intersections of opens with something called categorical product. So what's categorical product, or simply product? Well, basically a generalization of a notion of an intersection, some generalized intersection. So in the case of, how do you define product in the case of usual category of open subsets? Well, it's the largest open subset, which maps in sense of your category into all elements of the, well, suppose you have U and V. What's the intersection of U and V? It's the largest open subset, which is both inside U and inside V. So you can define similarly, similar notion for general category. You could just say, well, what is the largest object which maps into both U and V, which are objects of your category? That's called categorical product. Unions dually are defined as coproducts. So generalized union is a coproduct. What's coproduct? Well, it's the smallest thing to which both U and V map. Now, so that's how we think about this, what you do with the notion of union and intersection. But the most important thing is what you do with the notion of a covering. So you need to define what it means by, for a collection of objects to cover your single object. That actually is called Grothendieck topology. That's what this last item on this list. Well, instead of a topological space, you have now a notion of a site, a category with this Grothendieck topology. And once you have all this, you can define sheaves and co-sheaves exactly the same way as you define for topological space. Now, if you ask how you define notion of a covering in general, it's hard, but luckily we don't need to deal with that. So now this is a special, well, the category of open subsets is a very special category. It's called a thin category. Meaning, if you have two open subsets, if there, either there is an inclusion or there isn't. There's only one morphism at most. Okay. Now that you can encode in a very simple way. You can just say, well, if morphism space is non-empty, you write that U is less or equal than V. So your objects, you can encode the whole structure of a category simply in the, it's called pre-ordering. You just have a reflexive and transitive relation. So just if you just know this pre-ordering, you also know the structure of a category. Now, there's some notion, a related notion called a partially ordered set or poset, which might be more familiar. So in that case, you also impose this condition called anti-symmetry. If you have a U is less or equal than V, in V less or equal than U, then you won't say that U is equal to V. But that's not particularly natural in a categorical case because, you know, you never a good idea to say that two objects are equal. So you just drop this condition. And if that happens to be true, this and both this and this is true, all that means is that there are morphisms in both directions, which means that this object is just isomorphic. But you don't require them literally to be the same. Now, once you have notion of a, when you have a pre-ordered set, then notion of a generalized intersection and union become much simpler. You could just say, well, say the generalized union or coproduct, it's called a join in the theory of partially ordered sets. It's just the smallest element of your poset, which contains both U and which is bigger than both U and V. Okay. So it's defined up to, well, in the case of prosets, it's also defined the same way, just defined up to isomorphism. Not literally as an element, but they're all isomorphic in this sense. And product becomes meat. It's called meat. So you have the largest element of the set, which is containing both U and V, which is less than both U and V. Okay, by the way, in general, they don't exist. So to even make progress, you need to assume that they always exist. Okay, and once, if you have a category of this sort, then there is a very natural topology on that. Literally defined exactly the same way as for opens. You just say, well, this collection of elements covers this guy if, first of all, U isn't contained in all of them, but in the union, in this join, but also each one is individually contained in U. So that's literally the same way you would define it for opens. There's no, so like, well, of course, there are other topologies you can define, but this is like the most natural one. Okay, so let's try to use this. Well, so we already agreed that we don't have some sort of fuzzify our notion of an open subset. Let's, how do we do that? Well, suppose we have some lattice, and let's use to be some subset of this lattice, lambda, which you just think of as a metric space. And for any real number, positive real number, let's UR be the sort of thickening of this set. That is, a set of all points which are within distance R of my original set U. Okay, so, and we say that, we just say that U is fuzzily included in V. If U is, can be actually included, I should have written such a subset into this thickening of V typo here. So for example, all non-empty bounded subsets become an isomorphic object because in this category, like, you know, any blob of any diameter, if it's finite, can be included into the some thickening of another blob. Okay, so they all bounded subsets become the same, like a single point. Okay, so so then we consider, okay, so we can organize this we can organize all subsets of a lattice into some category using this preordering and say, well, we can just define this space, this Lie algebra, as the nice derivation which are approximately localized in the subset and do not excite the state. So the sort of symmetry of which symmetries which leave approximately on some subset, and then they form a Prikashev on this category. So just means the assignment of to every U of this guy is a functor. Well, I would actually like say that form a Kashif maybe, but for that we need to specify some topology on this category. Well, it's one of those categories we should know how to deal with. It's just a period set. Does it work? Well, not really, because I need to make sure that generalized intersection actually makes sense. Now, it's a general fact that you have some category and ask if there's a product for any two elements. Well, if it's there, it's unique up to isomorphism. But if it's not there, nothing can do about it. So you have the wrong, just not there. Okay. So it's easy to check actually for this category. If you just consider these general subsets, you're only going to have generalized products. They're just not true, and it's not surprising. A general subset Euclidean space is just some nightmare. What the hell is that? That's just, you cannot describe any all of them. Now that's a general a fact about which people know how to deal with. Kashavara and Shapiro actually have to deal with a similar issue in a context of analysis. And they say, well, there is a way out. Just restrict your subsets appropriately. What's appropriate restriction? Well, in their case, they restrict something called semi-algebraic or subanalytic subsets. Well, semi-algebraic is easier to define. They're just subsets of Euclidean space defined by a finite number of algebraic equalities and inequalities. So this is a very nice collection of subsets. If you check the literature on this, like we consider it for like 100 years, we have very nice properties from the point of view of logic. But for our purposes, well, I can probably do it within context here as well, but I'm not gonna, let's just simplify life. I consider something even smaller called semilinear subsets. There are different ways to define them. One way to say that they are defined by finite number of linear equalities and inequalities. Or another way, which is a bit more visual, first of all, define a polyhedron. It's a subset defined by, of Euclidean space defined by finite number of linear inequalities. So it's a convex subset. And then a semilinear subset, just a finite union of these guys. Okay. So now if you just restrict to those, you get a large supply of subsets. In particular, all these cones, which you considered all in there, but a lot more things. You need to, okay, so I would like to organize these guys into a category. Category use notion of a thickening. Well, luckily it's compatible. If you choose this infinity distance on Euclidean space, there's maximum of the differences of coordinates, actually a thickening of a semilinear set can show to be also semilinear. So you get a natural, yourself a nice category of these semilinear sets, and moreover, its coherent topology actually is well defined because once you restrict, you also do have general intersections and unions, well, all finite ones at least. Okay, so we have this nice logarithmic topology, and you can show that this assignment is actually a kerchief of vector spaces on this side. And that fact we use when we actually construct an anomaly indicator. So let me explain what this means. First of all, to construct an anomaly indicator, we can choose any cover of our Euclidean lattice. We use the kerchief property, so we can rewrite derivations, the sum of derivations supported in elements of the cover up to some ambiguity. And then we use one more thing, which is hasn't appeared. Well, I also have this Lie algebra structure on these vector spaces. So far, it didn't play any role, but when we construct an indicator, you need to know the following thing. If you take a commutator of commutator of elements of these guys, it leaves in the Lie algebra attached to the general intersection of the two. That's some additional properties. We can simplify a layer by noting that actually every semilinear set is isomorphic to a cone of some sort. And this, cone is generally a sense, like the cones I drew were like nice cones. Say a straight line is also a cone in the mathematical sense. But that sort of explains what's special about cones. Just because every semilinear set is actually isomorphic to a cone, and you can construct just cones. If you're interested in constructing a normal indicator, you can just use cones, maybe in a generalized sense.
So it is a special property of
Euclidean
geometry or
yeah, Euclidean space. But in general, I don't
physical content to the statement, or is there something?
No, we chose semilinear sets, and that was a choice. I didn't have to do it. I probably could use algebraic instead of semilinear. But once you made this choice, yes, to work with such states, you can reduce everything to cones.
A cone like a polyhedron, a cone could intersect itself, is that?
Sorry?
Like, is a compact thing is also a cone? I don't know what a cone is.
Cone, it's sort of a cone with a like empty base, if you wish. It's isomorphic to like a single point. So every bounded subset in this category is isomorphic to just a single point, which is the tip of the cone. So if you say the tip of the cone is also a cone,
okay,
which in some definitions it is, then yeah. Now that's not completely answers the question, but sort of, one still need to show that different covers give rise to the same anomaly indicator. Well, up to a factor, by the way. So, because sometimes you get different factor. Like for example, if you decompose your plane not into three cones, but of four cones, then you get twice the normal indicator for three cones. And if you decompose just two half planes, you get zero. So multiple could be also zero. That I haven't done. Now, another question which I haven't answered. What happens if you consider lattice systems on a cone, say half plane? Physically, you expect if it's gapped, all anomaly indicators to vanish. So how do you argue that? Now, if you go through these arguments we had with Nikita, these ad hoc arguments, you see that we are missing some structure still. We just said, well, if you have two subsets and such an inclusion, then there's a morphism. But actually, to make these arguments about independence of the choice of cones, you need to remember actually this number, or maybe remember the smallest such r. So actually, each morphism should be decorated with a real number. So I don't know how to deal with this in general, but there is something called enriched category, which says, well, If you have a symmetric monoidal category, then a category enriched in this has a not set of morphisms, but a object of this monoidal category instead of a set. Now, for example, suppose you have a just set of non-negative numbers plus infinity. You can think of it as a category if you want, monoidal category. But monoidal structure is addition, and category structure is because of ordering. So there's a morphism from A to B if A is greater than B, for example. So, okay, so we can say, what is an enriched category? What is a category enriched in this? Well, it's literally just a category such that you have a real number attached to every morphism. So, like, if you had like a, so that's one way to account for this more information. You just need to, you can actually upgrade this category to a category enriched in this, in this monoid. But I still don't know how to combine this with the topology on this category. So, but somehow, if you put this information together, you can probably have a nice argument why all anomaly indicators turned out to be the same, up to a factor. And as I promised, there'll be no punchlines. I'll stop here.
Any questions for Anton? We have like 15 minutes until the coffee break, so go ahead.
So this site of cons in RM that you told us about, it has all sorts of like, I mean, any site has sort of things like Atal topology. Have you looked
at what?
Have you tried to just measure the abstract kind of algebraic topology of this site of semi-linear sets?
I don't even know what algebraic topology of a site is, so no.
I mean, like, for instance, you know, calculating the category sheaves of sets.
Well, yeah, in low dimensions, actually, it's probably not very hard because actually this category is equivalent as a sight to just a category of polyhedral subsets of the sphere at infinity. So with the usual notion of inclusion. So that's actually another connection with the edge quantum field theory, perhaps, because this non-classical stuff in the bulk is actually equivalent to classical category, classical topological space, essentially, at infinity.
Yeah. Can you tell us which part of your argument the cones breaks down in like r dimensions?
It doesn't break down. It's just you get nothing. You get zero. Nothing, you can construct anything using this method. Doesn't mean that there are no other anomaly indicators. They don't have any way to classify all possible anomaly indicators. But if you just do the same thing, you don't get anything non-zero.
Yeah. So you mentioned you can't get a anomaly indicator for any lead group.
Yes.
You consider net finite groups. Is it possible to reproduce that cohomology classification from this formula?
Well, I mean, yeah, there was already a question like that. So, and the answer is for finite unitary groups, it's possible. There's a paper by Nikita, which explains how to do that in a different way in two dimensions. It only, we should be careful though, because to generalize, to get anomaly indicators, you need to, for finite symmetries, you need to assume that this system is an invertible, short-range entangled phase to begin with, right? So here I didn't assume that, I just assumed gap condition. So it's a bit more subtle theory. And second, anti-unitary symmetries are still out of reach in this way, so I don't know how to deal with them.
Could you say what is so complicated about that?
Well, nothing complicated, just conceptual stumbling block is that all this, well, like here, for example, to define the indicator, you're considering localizing symmetry to part of the system. So you cannot like time reverse, you know, what does it mean to time reverse part, you know, only part of the system? Technically, the problem is that star algebras define the product over complex numbers of an infinite number of star algebras, right? So you're stuck with the global time reversal then if you work with that object.
So should I think that the vanishing of this on the half plane is coming from a cancellation from the bulk and the edge?
I'm not sure how to think about it this way. So the way we prove it essentially like this. So you can imagine, like, say, have this half plane, and suppose you did the same thing, you just had three cones, right? That's a good, well, in that case, it seems like it might be non-zero, but then you notice that actually if you take this cone, which the upper one, the lowest one, and the up and the bottom, you actually move them away from each other without changing the normal indicator. And as you take the limit as they're farther and farther from each other, you just find it, you know, the indicator goes to zero clearly. So that's how we prove it. So I don't know how to think in terms of constellations and bulk and boundary, because we have only the whole system. We just have the gapped system on a half space. I don't know how to decompose into bulk.
Sorry, what are you moving away from?
Well, I'm just, let's see. I just imagine like doing the same argument, but say for right half plane. So, okay, so you can just imagine doing three regions covering this. And it seems at first you could get something non-zero here from the, but so you have like Q1, Q2, you have essentially this, roughly speaking, as your normal indicator, well, omega. But in reality, that's always zero, because you can argue that nothing changes if you replace this region 3 with this.
I guess I thought you were putting the center of the cone inside of the bulk, and then there was another edge.
Yeah, so you could also do, okay, sorry. I put the center of the cone anywhere.
Okay.
The point is, first of all, show that it doesn't matter where you put it.
Even if you put it to the edge.
Well, yeah. So, but say conical, I didn't have to work with, I can work with anything which is is a cone at infinity, sort of, for large distance. So I could have, say this is like sort of, not a cone, but it's cone like sufficiently far, right? So it's equivalent in this category to a cone. Like it still counts as a cone. So it's basically this property that I can take the distance to infinity and nothing changes, that gives me zero.
I was going to ask a question about, like, in 3D, for example, we should be able to construct a similar anomaly indicator?
No, we expect anomaly indicators to be non-trivial only in even dimensions, because that's where Chern-Simons terms exist. Then the space and dimension is odd, so you have Chern-Simons terms.
But, like, geometrically, I thought I could just put these charges, Q1, up to Q8, for instance.
No, you can, of course, you can put cones, but you don't get any non-trivial anomaly indicator in that case. No, you know, if you just, you can do, like, say, in one dimension, it's easier to picture.
So the statement is that your anomaly indicator is basically the Chern-Simons term.
Yeah.
If you take the thermodynamic limit or something like that?
Well, it's already in thermodynamic limit, because everything is in my space is infinite to begin with.
Because your group is your what?
No, and for any group, Chern-Simons terms exist only in in odd space-time dimensions, right?
Sure, but I mean, other groups have more interesting cohomology, like even Lie theoretically, Lie algebraic cohomology.
You mean non-compact groups?
No, I mean like there's all, like Euler characteristic terms can be an odd degree.
Well, Chern-Simons terms are always classified just in a way.
Yes, but. What I'm trying to ask is if your group is more complicated than U1.
No, you're still going to get only odd space-time dimensions. For finite groups, you can get anomaly indicators, you know, in any dimension. If the group is connect, okay, someone considering infinitesimal anomalies, right? If you consider non-infinitesimal, you can get anomaly in any dimension.
Do you eyeball anomalies that are more general than Chern-Simons?
I don't see them in this formalism. Maybe it will be very interesting if there are some examples where I expect from field theory something else, something which exists only in even dimension, because I don't see any way from the lattice to construct some infinitesimal anomaly in odd spatial dimension.
But sorry, on that same vein, what if you had like a zero form symmetry and a one form symmetry?
In this setup, I don't have any.
Okay.
Higher form symmetries, because the lattice system has a product algebra.
Right. Okay.
In fact, in a crucial point in this, you can think of this statement that any symmetry, well, so there's a more general theorem which includes that fact that you can split a derivation into these regions, which essentially says that there are no higher form symmetries in for gapped states. So in general, you could so if you have a gapped state in any dimension, and ask, are there any continuous higher-form symmetries there? You can prove that there aren't any. No continuous higher-form symmetries. For gapless ones, there could be. But this is tied to this same fact that Kitaev proved, that you can split the Hamiltonian into these local Hamiltonians, which are also symmetries of the state. That doesn't work in higher dimensions, in a gapless case. And for that reason, you can have continuous higher-form symmetries in the gapless state as well.
Are you familiar with these bulk wave function descriptions of chiral central charge and higher chiral central charge? I think they show up in the quantum info literature, but haven't been as put as a GMS formal.
Yeah, I'm familiar with them, but I'm not convinced that they actually work beyond free fermion systems. So it's very difficult to check anything. You mean like this modular commutator?
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's not clear to me that's well defined. Because modular commutator is a very subtle thing, and modular Hamiltonian is a very subtle thing, and we know almost nothing about its locality properties. Well, I would say actually we know nothing about its locality properties. So I don't know how to argue that it's well defined. For free fermions, you can show that it is well defined, but it's a very special case.
Good question.
Yeah.
So in this algebraic setting, you first build the algebra and then you build the state and then you get the Hilbert space. I assume that the anomalies of a system do not depend on the state, though.
Well, so there are different notions of anomaly, right? So the anomalies. So here I'm trying to detect anomalies of the edge quantum field theory, basically, mm-hmm. without using edge quantum field theory. So then what do I have? To specify edge quantum field theory, at least I might need to specify bulk state. So the symmetries I'm worried about here are symmetries of the bulk ground state. There's a separate issue. Just consider symmetries of kinematic symmetries of some system. Can they have anomaly? Just lattice system when some action cannot be localized. So so that's a separate issue, and it's not one can define similar obstructions for that problem. Although, turns out that at least in one dimension, you don't find anything interesting if you look at only infinitesimal symmetries. It's a very distinct question. So, anomalies in field theory clearly exist for even for infinitesimal symmetries, and the same is true for anomalies of the bulk wave function. But if you ask, are there anomalies just of lattice system which don't respect any gapped ground state, just anomalies of action of a symmetry on an algebra. Mm-hmm. I kind of doubt that there are anomalies, infinitesimal anomalies in that case, mm-hmm. even though they can be anomalies for discrete symmetries.
That was if the symmetry is emergent.
So only emergent symmetry can have, only emergent continuous symmetry can have an anomaly, mm-hmm. basically. I don't know if it's true, but in one dimension we can show it's true.
It's about time for the coffee break, so let's save any fruit.